out there in podcast land, and welcome to a special episode for the Front Row Network, a part of the Community Voices for NPR Illinois and the podcast for people who actually like movies, I think, anyway. We're going to find that out tonight. But it is Oscar week, and that means next Sunday is the 93rd Annual Academy Awards, and this year we thought we would handle our Oscar coverage just a little bit differently. Instead of doing the major category breakdowns, we have invited a panel of Front Row hosts to come together for our first ever Oscar Forum, where we will break down the 8 films nominated for Best Picture. But before we discuss how the forum's going to run, let's see who is here. I'll start. I am Vanessa Ferguson, co-host of Beyond the Mouse, and I will be moderating this lively bunch. Tonight's panel includes the charming Steve Sykes from A View from the Back Row. Hello, Steve.
Hello, Vanessa.
We also have my co-host from Beyond the Mouse, who may very well ditch our family-friendly routine for more salty language tonight. It's going to terrify me, but that's okay. From Beyond the Mouse, it's Craig McFarland.
Hello, Vanessa. I like Steve's so much. Sorry.
I'm just glad you didn't go right into the swearing right away. It does hurt me a little bit inside, my Disney heart. Also, the oh-so-classy from Classics, Mr. Brandon Davis.
Hello, Vanessa.
Hello. And Brandon, you should know that I've really been forced to do this hosting tonight, and I feel underprepared. So I'm going to be looking to you for all your wise historical Oscar moments that you can share with us. That's
I'll try.
That's still on you, buddy. Okay. I'm not okay. Quite to Classics level yet.
Okay.
Also, an instigator, if I ever saw one, from Guilty Pleasures, it's the real Lou Hare.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Sure. I will be proven right as this podcast goes along tonight. Also, we have my journalism brother from another mother, Jay Hoffman from Flashbacks.
Hello. I'm here to bring the goddamn salty language in.
Ooh, all right. And it could be Marissa Tomei, or it could be Aaron McKay from Flashbacks. Hello, Aaron.
Vanessa, it's always such a pleasure to be on with such a lovely lady as yourself.
Ah, thank you. And I'm sure you just love that every time I see you, I tell you remind me of Marissa Tomei.
Love that when I wear leopard print or anything, and I obviously am also Italian, I then text her and I'm like, oh my God, you're right. I do look like Marissa Tomei.
It's a gift. Own it. It's a gift. And finally, one of our newest podcasters on the Front Row Network, Mr. Ethan Fant, host of a podcast called Indie Spotlight.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Very happy to be here with all of you tonight.
Now, Ethan, I don't know if they told you this, but since it is your first time being on a Front Row Network podcast, we have to ask you, what is your favorite movie and Yikes. Why?
No, this is going to go bad.
Terrible for me as well. And I hate
great.
That.
Great. The typical answer I throw out, and I don't know even if it's true, is Forrest Gump.
Forrest Gump, that's a great one. And I, last but not least here, we have a, joining us from Flashbacks is a top-notch guy, Mr. Ryan Lutens.
You know, I was going to thank you, but then you forgot me, so it's okay. Yeah. No, it's all good, Vanessa. Thank
no one
you
would
so
have
much.
Known. Thank you for rolling with it in a very good improv-y way and not calling me out, but that's okay.
No, thank you for hosting what is about to go down. You know, I hope your blood pressure doesn't rise and... good luck.
He's just us crapping on him on Flashbacks all the time. So he's very, very defensive.
I really am. Especially when it comes to Jay.
Sorry, the salty
Vanessa,
language.
I'm usually you in the Flashbacks podcast between these two. So
all right. Well, I'm not gonna regret this at all tonight.
Nope.
But let's go ahead and keep things moving. So these fine folks are here today to break down each one of the Best Picture nominees. They're gonna tell us a short synopsis about the film. I challenge you to do it in one or two sentences if you can. Give their critique of the film, and then they're also gonna talk about the film's nominations, if there was a surprise or a snub, and of course what they want it to win. And what they think it will win. After that discussion, and we'll let our panelists chime in just a little bit here. And then after that, we're going to give our panelists some time to discuss and really talk about at the end who they think is going to win Best Picture, just Best Picture. We know you're filling out your ballots at home, and we want to give you the best guess we can so that you're prepared for Oscar night. But I think it's going to be a little bit of a long podcast, so I'm going to recommend to you to grab your soda, grab your popcorn, grab your No Man's Land bucket. It could be a while, but let's get started. So I'm actually going to go to Ryan first, since I skipped you. Let's start with you first. Plus, we're doing this alphabetically, so you're going to be talking about The Father. You yes. Start us off.
Okay, so, you know, breakdown of what The Father is about. Anthony Hopkins plays a man named Anthony who is trying to keep his independence as he grows older. But little to his knowledge, he is starting to have his reality break down in front of him. And his daughter is trying to support him any way that she can. And their relationship is strained. But as Anthony's reality becomes marred more and more because of dementia, he begins to realize that reality is not what it seems. How was that, Vanessa? Pretty short.
That was good. I'm going to award some points. I think I'll give you 5 points for a good short synopsis.
All right, perfect. My critique on this movie, it's definitely the one that came out of the gates first. I know Anthony Hopkins got a lot of rave reviews to start, and he is fantastic in this. But this movie was an exceptional movie. It was an emotional roller coaster only brought on because of Anthony Hopkins' performance, but more importantly, supported by Olivia Colman in Best Supporting Actress. But this is definitely an emotional movie that plays at the heart. What I really enjoyed about this movie is the fact that this movie really allowed you to see and be in the moment of what Anthony was feeling. And I'm, you know, Anthony, the character, you see how his world and his reality is deteriorating from his point of view. And that's a thing that the filmmaker does on purpose. So you're really going through this journey with him. And when the ending happens, you're just kind of flabbergasted because it's not really a twist of an ending. But you're just like, wow. You're just floored by it, especially Anthony Hopkins breaks down at the end, and you're floored by the emotional performance. This is definitely not the most happy movie of the Oscar season, but it was definitely one of the most emotional, and it brings an emotional core. So that's what I think makes it such a good movie. This movie is nominated for 6 Academy Awards. Obviously, it's nominated for Best Picture, but it's also nominated for Best Actor and Best Supporting Actress. This is Olivia Colman's 2nd nomination. The Best Supporting Actress category is just completely, you know, bonkers right now. So that could be anybody's game. But Anthony Hopkins rightly deserves this nomination. I think him and Chadwick Boseman are neck and neck. But Chadwick is just storming the gate. So, you know, it is what it is. Other thing that it's nominated for is Best Adapted Screenplay. This was originally a play by the director, who is Florian Zeller. So Best Adapted Screenplay, it's also nominated for Best Production Design, which, again, that's something that's really unique about this movie, and something that they did purposefully with the character of Anthony, because he sees things as his flat. So as he's going to the doctors, he sees it as his flat. That's just one of the many things that they do to show how his reality is deteriorating because of dementia. Lastly, it was nominated for Best Film Editing. Again, really does a great job designating, you know, what we see and what Anthony Hopkins sees, you know, and just the takes that they do, especially with the dialogue, just really makes you run in circles, especially when you're really feeling what he feels. You know, the only real snub that I would say that this movie kind of missed out on is the director, Florian Zeller. This was his baby. He has 3 of these. He has 3 of these plays, The Father, The Son, and The Mother. We just found out that The Son is being greenlit to be made. But yeah, I think that there's some credit there that he may have missed a Best Director spot. But the director of Another Round, Thomas Vinterberg, I think he's phenomenal too. So what do I think this movie will win in a race where all the other categories are a little bit, you know, you see kind of a front runner. I think this movie has the best bet of adapted screenplay. But again, that could be upset by Nomadland. But really, adapted screenplay and production design, maybe film editing, but I don't think Anthony Hopkins or Olivia Colman will walk away this year. That's all I've got. How'd I do? Less than 5 minutes?
It was beautiful. Take note, panelist. That was amazing. Anybody have any thoughts on Anthony Hopkins? You know, he did win the BAFTA, but it's a British award. So, you know, he's probably not going to win this this award. But anyone have any thoughts on, could he possibly take it?
You know, I think he's just a stellar actor. And by the way, I have to say, first of all, it took everything in my being to not interrupt you, Ryan, when you couldn't remember the word dementia right, while you were talking about this film. But I will say that, you know, it's a stellar performance. This is, to me, as an example of the character piece. I'm going to say something controversial. I did just finish watching this, and Olivia Colman, to me, doesn't do enough in this film to merit her nomination to Best Actress, because she's a fine actress. She's amazing. We've seen her in, of course, The Favorite, and we love The Crown right now. But it's just, to me, this was all spotlight on Anthony Hopkins. He is phenomenal. I don't believe he's going to win. I think that rightly the award will go to the Best Actor of the Year, and that was Chadwick Boseman. But the film overall, you know, I could see it winning in editing possibly because of the way that they really shot this and showed you a way to kind of explore the idea of what is it like if you have dementia. And that's something that we all hear about all the time. We hear about this terrible disease that takes away your memories and takes away your, in a way, some of your sanity. But we haven't necessarily been able to experience it in the way that this film brings it to you and really puts it in your face. So a wonderful character piece, very well adapted, very well edited. I don't know that it's going to walk away with many trophies, but that to me is not necessarily the mark of a great piece, right? And a great film. So this was definitely worth a watch. As Ryan rightly pointed out, it is not the happiest film of the Oscar year, but it is definitely worth a watch. And I would highly suggest people go out and check it out.
Is it the saddest of the year?
You know, the saddest of the year might be, and we'll get into it, I'm sure, but it might be a movie about nothing that seems to be winning a lot of awards. In my opinion, that might be the saddest of the year.
Took
but
10 minutes. 10 easy minutes. Sport.
All right.
Lou, thank you for taking the set there, Craig.
Lou, I'm sorry. I called you an instigator. I actually need to pass that title off to Jay.
I'm just sitting here chilling.
You've been doing great. Jay's over here poking bears, but
now you see what I put up with.
I do see it, but you know what? We're going to have to give Jay his time because he needs to tell us about Judas and the Black Messiah. So Jay, let's see how you can sum this up for us.
I'll do my best. Unfortunately, I watched it 2 months ago when it was free on HBO. So I'm doing my best from Wikipedia and memory. But it's a film about the betrayal of Fred Hampton, chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party in the 1960s by William O'Neill. And it digs also into Hoover's, you know, director of the FBI, his attack, all out attack against the Black Panther Party, and how that story unfolds and how the Black Panther Party is infiltrated and in the long run turned on. And it's just that story playing out. I think for me, so that's my summary. There's not much more to get into for that. And this is a film too, you know, there's historical documents out there, but I'll be honest with you, this was a blind spot for me, you know? And, cause I was watching it and my wife straight goes, "What do you know about the Black Panthers?" And I was like, a more militant brand of civil rights. I don't know. I just know what we've seen in things like Forrest Gump, which was very minimal. It was just like Forrest being like, "Sorry, I interrupted your party." So I think that the time of this movie coming out, with all the stuff that happened this past summer with the Black Lives Matter, with currently we're going through the George Floyd Officer Chauvin trial for something that took place in the 1960s. I don't know that it could have felt more timely than it did coming out this year. I thought it was a really, really interestingly filmed autobiography story laying out of this tale that happened. And I think it's one that people didn't really know about. Well, I should say maybe the general public didn't know about. I'm sure there are some groups that this is very, very, some demographics this is very, very effective and very, very personal for. But for those that it's not, I think it was really great that this was brought to the forefront. And so I think from a social commentary angle, this movie is really important. I think we will be talking about it for a long time. I think the acting in it was phenomenal. I think it was really, really good. And Fred Hampton, man, I thought that was Fred Hampton on screen. I mean, I think it was that good. And Steve said in our group chat, holy crap, Fred Hampton's the dude from Get Out. I didn't even know it was the same guy. And he looks the same, but you get so lost in his performance that I think it's very, very easy to miss that. So my thoughts on it, I think it's a really great social commentary piece, a really great piece of historical narrative. From a technical perspective, I don't know that there was anything for me that stood out from like a cinematically. I do think there was some cool shots of Fred Hampton as he was walking into a church and moving through the crowds. There were some interesting shots, but overall I felt like the social commentary and the historical narrative is what's important about this film. It's nominated for 6 Academy Awards. Best Picture, obviously. We have 2 Best Supporting Actors. So Daniel, Kaluuya?
Kaluuya, yep.
Okay. As Fred Hampton, Lakeith Stanfield is the man who turned on him, the titular Judas. Best Original Screenplay, Best Cinematography, and Best Original Song. And I did just listen to that song, and it's a hell of a good song. So that's the nominations. You got some questions for me on those nominations, Vanessa?
I do. I'm curious to hear from you who you think are actually going to take home those awards.
I think Daniel Kaluuya is going to win Best Supporting Actor. I don't know the other original songs that are up. So I'm not sure. I'll tell you that song's a hell of a good song. I just, like I said, listened to it right before because it'd been a minute since I'd heard it. Best Picture, I don't think it's going to win that. Screenplay, I'm liking Promising Young Woman a little too much. And I'm very confused because I thought Lakeith Stanfield was a lead actor. I thought he was the lead of the picture. So I was very confused. I think he also stated he was very confused. Ryan had something.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest surprise of this entire panel is that nomination, because even he was like, what the hell?
You know what, though? It's really interesting because we talked about this a bit last year with Brad Pitt. You know, the thought of who is the lead and who is the support really just depends on who they want to nominate. Because you can make the argument, too, that even though this is called Judas and the Black Messiah, so Judas comes first. So Lakeith Stanfield is first in the title, right? You can certainly argue that Daniel Kaluuya is also a lead actor in this film. He's just so fantastic all the way through. He really morphs into that role of Fred Hampton. And like you were saying, Jay, this film is so socially relevant to today, and not at all something that we would have thought been able to listen to and think about in public schools and as we were growing up. And, you know, I followed 1968 quite a bit, but the assassination of Fred Hampton is not something that necessarily even me, having done more than just a tertiary glance at that year, had really dove into. And so it's just a very, very well done picture for sure.
Lou, you had a thought on the film?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I mean, I would agree with what both of you, I think it, but I think you're talking co-leads. I think the film gives almost time to screen time, or at least the narrative is equally focused on the two of them. But just to kind of say something that you would, you know, parrot what you would said a little bit, Craig, is that, you know, one cliche we always hear is history is written by the winners. And because the Black Panther movement ended and kind of died out, partly because of the assassination of Fred Hampton, you know, that narrative got to be formed by the people who ended the Black Panther movement. So to have that story told, I think was really important. The thing that also really strikes me the more I think about the film is, you know, we're doing a lot of reckoning with race in this past year. And I'm not the best voice to talk about that, but one of the things that I think we have talked about a lot is the stereotype of the quote unquote angry Black man. And I think some of that stereotype is born in how the Black Panthers were demonized in a lot of ways. And this movie shines a light on they weren't just a bunch of, you know, people yelling, screaming in the streets, like wanting to set fire to everything or whatever. They were in their communities. They were doing wonderful things for the people within their community. And that's a side we did, you know? And so they're, you know, because of how the narrative has been shaped, I think this movie does a really good thing of not only just pointing out another side to that story, but also trying to bust a little bit of a stereotype that has been, you know, perpetuated for decades because of, you know, the people in charge getting to control the narrative.
That's really interesting. Growing up in Chicago, I knew a lot about the Black Panthers and the breakfast programs they had and the school programs they had and the Oakland chapters and how gangs were formed on the South Side, the Stones and other community advocacy groups within the Black communities here in Chicago who formed their own, you know, their own groups with to protect their own neighborhoods and provide community. So it's interesting to hear other people's perspectives too, because growing up in Chicago, I knew a lot about that. To hear that, like, outside of Chicago, maybe it wasn't that way. So it was like, my view of the Black Panthers was not only what was put out there by Forrest Gump, you know what I mean? Even though that is what's out there. So it's also interesting to see how geographically exposure can be on certain parts of history in towns and cities as well as far as different, I don't know. That's fascinating because I didn't even realize this. I thought everyone just knew more, you know.
No, after that movie, I was like, I didn't know any of this.
Yeah. Aaron, if you've learned nothing by being part of this group, it's that you're smarter than most of us. So,
stop it.
Yeah. Well, I'd say too, if you need any more reinforcement of the importance of the story, it's also told in Trial of Chicago 7, another Best Picture nominee. So, for anyone out there who isn't aware, check out both those movies.
That's right. I'm so glad that we have these important pieces of film to enjoy even after the Oscar season is over that we can learn from. But let's keep moving on here. Although I think we should point out, though, that it does sound like that this film will take most likely the supporting actor win, as well as possibly best song. It does sound like it's leaning that way, although perhaps another one could jump in, but we'll find out more as we go along here. Next, I believe we have to hear from, if there was ever a film made for Brandon to talk about, I think it is a modern film. I think it would be Mank. So I'm so excited to hear what he has to say about this film.
Yeah, I'm not going to go too deep into the discussion of the actual plot of the movie, because if you want to hear that, you can go back and hear our full disclosure of Mank, which was recorded back in November.
That's my man.
So, but
shameless plugs, brother. Keep it up.
It's true. But yeah, I really explained my thoughts on sort of the plot and everything in that episode. Mank, for those of you listening who haven't seen it, it's 1933 to 1940 span of time in Hollywood, seen through the eyes of Herman Mankiewicz, a screenwriter. And this is Hollywood at a time when We were in the midst of a depression when World War II was looming. The threat of communism got everybody paranoid, and Mankiewicz was, he had the keys to the kingdom in terms of witnessing all of these great figures and how they responded positively and negatively to what was going on. And this is all done within the period of him writing, co-writing. Everybody has their opinion on who wrote Citizen Kane, but but basically during that time. And it's really not a making of Citizen Kane movie. It is a character study of Mankiewicz done visually and narratively through how Citizen Kane was made. So a lot of flashbacks going back and forth through time, a lot of you know, deep focus camera techniques, really, really crisp and clear black and white. Beautiful looking movie. I love the little touches. This movie's attention to detail is crazy. I watched it for a second time, and there are so many Easter eggs in this movie that harken back to shots that you can see through Kane that only diehard fans who have watched that movie many times will know. I also love that when you get to the end of certain scenes, there's little pops and flickers in the corner of the screen like they're changing reels, like this movie was filmed on nitrate film. David Fincher, the director of this movie, you could tell this was a labor of love for him. What I'm going to talk about now, though, is I've had a couple of months, I've seen this twice now, and a concern that I brought up in our episode, it's still a concern that I have, and is that it is so wonderfully and expertly made, I think it was only made for a specific kind of audience, which is what is hurting it in terms of reviews I've read from other people, reviews I've read from professional critics. It was made for me. I loved it. I was engrossed in it. I love black and white. I wish we made more movies in black and white. I think you can tell so many different kinds of stories that way. Gary Oldman gives such a fantastic performance. You feel like this is a character right out of the 30s, just the way he speaks, his countenance and everything else. And it's wonderfully cast. I just think it doesn't have his arms as wide open to a wider swath of audience. And so I think that that's what's going to hurt it. This is a movie that the Academy loves. It's a movie about movie making. It's a movie about movie history. It's a shame that Jack Fincher, David Fincher's dad, who wrote the screenplay, passed away, because I wish he would have been around to sort of make tweaks to the screenplay while his son was making this, because maybe it would have been a more accessible film that way. But I think it's definitely worthy of a nomination. I think it's a movie that will be studied for years to come. But yeah, I don't see it winning. It does have the most nominations, nominated for Best Director, Best Picture, Best Actor for Gary Oldman, Best Actress for Amanda Seyfried, Best Original Score, Sound, Cinematography, Production Design, Costume Design, Makeup and Hairstyling. And I think it's got a great chance with some of these technical awards, Production Design and Cinematography, because it envelops you in its world. And you were there from, you know, point one. And it absolutely does envelop you. And the other one that I think it's got a good shot at, I think it's a wide open category, but to me, Amanda Seyfried, her performance is kind of like an oasis in this movie. Anytime she's on screen, your eyes go to her. She's so bubbly, but she's so intelligent, and she is so not your stereotypical blonde character that you would see in a 30s movie. It's not the image that the public had of Marion Davies at the time, and I think she just delivers it perfectly. So those are my current thoughts on Mank, and if you want to hear more in detail, full disclosure of Mank, recorded back in November.
Excellent. Did anyone have any thoughts on any of those categories? I mean, some of them are up in the air. Cinematography, production design, I think might have it for Mank, but there are a few that are a question mark. Any thoughts on what, who might get what on Oscar night?
I think that supporting actress category is really interesting, because there's such a wide swath of performances in different kinds of films represented in that category, because you have her, you've got Olivia Colman in The Father, Yoon Jung-yeon for Minari, Maria Bakalova for Borat subsequent movie film, and then Glenn Close for Hillbilly Elegy, who's also nominated for a Razzie for the same performance. So like, we're running the gamut of like types of performances. I think it's an interesting category, but she's been a talented actress. I don't even call her a young actress, or because it feels like she's been around for forever, but That's an interesting one.
The fact that these guys, the built Hearst Mansion, like built it, is just it floored me. And I mean, the attention to detail, like Brandon said, is just incredible. You know, even though it's black and white, you can still see all the nooks and crannies, every corner of that mansion. I think they're going to take it, to be honest.
They basically built stuff out of nothing, which is how they made Citizen Kane. It's a lot of, you know, special effects and things made out of thin air in this movie.
I think Gary Oldman, for me, this performance is one of my favorite ever. Like, I love that character. Like, Mank is one of my favorite characters, I think, in movies ever. And I agree with Brandon that I think on the surface, like for me, because I'm not really into like the history of film being filmed. Like, it's not like the only reason I was really interested. I was like, Gary Oldman and David Fincher, the director of Alien 3 there, Craig. I'm in. I want to see what they do. And I think once you get past that surface level, the dialogue is super witty in this. And Mank is just this, I don't know, he's just a great character. And I think that dialogue and that stuff, I think if people can give it a chance and really pay attention to the dialogue and what's happening, like, that's what sucked me in. So I really, really liked Mank as well. And I really didn't expect to like it as much as I did.
It will be interesting to see what awards it can take home. It, like Brandon said, it has the most awards with 10. And in the past, we used to be able to tell who was going to be the best picture winner by the number of awards. But that is not the case, as we've seen in most recent years. So let's move on, though, to...
I do have one fun fact before.
Oh, sure.
About I love about fun this. Facts. This is actually the...
Me too.
Of all of the Best Picture nominees, at 2 hours and 11 minutes, this is the longest of the Best Picture nominees, which sounds crazy because normally Best Picture nominees are, you know, these 2.5-3 hour long movies. So I just thought that was really interesting that the longest movie on this whole list was 2 hours and 11 minutes. So if you're like on the fence about watching these movies, they're all relatively short. A lot of them are under 2 hours. So you should definitely do that. And if you cut out all the times they say the word Mank in this movie, it cuts it down to like 45, 46 minutes. So,
wow.
Yeah.
I feel like last year, the shortest movie in the Best Picture category was 2 hours and 11 minutes.
Probably.
Also, yeah. Also, I'm pretty sure Nomadland hit like the 5 hour mark.
Yeah, I am a little surprised to hear you say that that Mank was the longest, because that's not how it felt in my heart. But let's not have this conversation be the longest. Let's move on to Minari, I believe is how everyone's mostly been saying it, although I have heard it pronounced Minotti. But that is Ethan. Please tell us about this film.
Yes. So Minari is how I'm going to say it, because I don't think I'll be able to say it the other way very well. Is an immigrant story of a first-generation Korean family moving to the United States about their path of making it in America. We pick up already a little bit of ways through their journey. They have lived in California for a while, working as chicken sexers, identifying male and female chicks as their job. They move to Arkansas to continue that. And when they get there, each family member has their own idea of how they want to make it in America. And that ends up being kind of the central conflict amongst the family of who's doing what and why. And I think it's an interesting movie because everyone is wrong and right at one point or another throughout this movie. Each one has their ideas of why they're doing what they're doing, and they think they're doing it for the greater good, but oftentimes it can come off as self-serving rather than holistically altruistic. I think there's only one character who is kind of impeachable, and that's the daughter, Anne, who always seems to be kind of like this bright shining light for everyone to kind of be drawn to. But yeah, so that's kind of the crux of the movie. As far as nominations go, it has 6 nominations for Best Picture, obviously. Best Actor for Steven Yeun. Best Supporting Actress for Yoon Yoo-jung, who plays the grandma. Best Original Score, Best Director, and Best Original Screenplay. Best Director and Original Screenplay, both for Lee Isaac Chung. As far as the category, I think it has the best chance to win. For me, Best Supporting Actress, I think, for me, is where this one shines the most. The grandma in this movie is absolutely just kind of breathtaking with all of her abilities to be her facial expressions and her seemingly improvisational style and her childlike wonder in some ways. Supposing to be the maternal figure of the family, but ends up being kind of the most childlike of any of them in the family, which is an interesting dynamic. I also think after talking with different friends who come from like first generation immigrant families or second generation, that most of these types of movies are usually told from the kid's perspective, but this movie was told from holistically from everyone's perspective within the family. Like everyone had their first person view moment within the film, which I thought was interesting. Another thing to note, a few of my Korean friends did tell me that Steven Yeun was horrible at speaking Korean, and they are shocked that he got the nomination for best actor. So I can't comment on that because I don't speak Korean at all. So I wouldn't be able to tell one way or the other, but I just thought that that was an interesting thing. And I know people have brought that up too with other TVs, shows and movies, Narcos being one where the guy who plays Escobar isn't actually Spanish. I believe he's Portuguese. So he had to kind of reframe how he spoke as well. I think Steven Yeun had to do the same thing, but still all great performances all around. Will Patton, I think, is also another shining light in this movie. For those who don't know Will Patton, but have seen Remember the Titans, he is the football coach opposite Denzel Washington. But he plays an exuberant character, to say the least. But he gives a pretty unique performance that I enjoyed very much. So yeah, those are my comments on Minari.
Ryan, I saw you shaking your head when we were talking about Ye Jong-yoon. So why don't you give us your thoughts on this film?
For me, with Best Supporting Actress and how wide open it is, she came out of left field. She won the SAG Award, you know, and I believe she won the BAFTA. But she is not a traditional grandma. And I love that the little boy says that. But when the little boy gets to know her and you're getting to know her, you realize that she is like your grandmother. She's very caring and nurturing. And tragedy befalls her. And you still believe her as an actress doing what she can to help the family, you know, despite what happened to her. And in probably one of the most powerful moments, she's just walking down a road by herself. And it's just so powerful in that moment because her expressions, and after that fact, when she's sitting and watching the family, her expressions tell her story. She doesn't have to say a word. So I thought she was brilliant. But I also, a snub, man, that little boy killed it. I love that little boy. He was fantastic.
For sure. Craig, you had thoughts on the film.
Well, I was actually, this is the one Oscar nominee I have not seen yet. So I don't have facts, any input on the film, but I do want to teach Ethan how to shamelessly plug his own shows. He did just record an episode on Minari with his co-host Kimmy, and that will also be coming up this week on the Front Row Network feed. So we're really excited to bring Indie Spotlight and to bring this show to the Front Row Network. And I think it's going to be a much different show and much different vibe than even what we have. So really looking forward to it. And the reason I was really talking about this was just to make sure that I could spend as much time as possible before we had to get to Nomadland. So that's why I wanted to make sure I chimed in here.
Well, I appreciate it, Craig.
I was going to say, we're going to have to move on soon, but Jay, you had some thoughts on the film.
Yeah, I just watched it today. And I could, like, in this movie, you know, you said it's the immigrant story trying to build a life. And it's like literally like one thing after the next, blocking that and like, you know, creating half. I could not have picked a better week and a half to have watched it. I just had back-to-back kids with hand, foot, and mouth disease. And then my daughter broke her wrist right into a birthday party a few hours ago. I was like, this movie's speaking to my soul right now. Like, I can't believe it. But the grandmother, at first I was like, what is wrong with this lady? And then as you watch it unfold, you're like, this lady's awesome. I want to watch wrestling and gamble and talk shit to her. It looks so fun. But at first I was like I couldn't figure out what her deal was, and it just slowly unfolds and all these layers peel out. So I would agree with Ethan. I think I liked Amanda in Mank, but I mean, she's really good. Is she from Korea, or is She's from Korea. Okay.
I've heard her called on another podcast. Not that I listen to others, guys, but, you know. The Meryl Streep of Korea. So yeah,
she has 5 decades of experience in film and TV. So she's a heavy hitter.
Okay.
You know, speaking for the flashback crew, though, the fact that this movie is set in the 80s, perfect.
Excellent. We had a flashback, and you can listen to flashbacks. We got to take Craig's advice on wherever you listen to your podcast. You can check out the Front Row Network's flashbacks. I don't know if we're going to be talking about Oscar-worthy films on there. Are they? You haven't done City Slickers, and I think that's a tragedy.
We did Fargo. But...
We are dropping Silence of the Lambs for Oscar Weeker.
All right.
We cover the gamut on Flash.
We're classing it up.
Great. And whenever you get around to City Slickers, that will be the cherry on top. But Steve Sykes has been a little bit quiet, and I think it's because we're going to be spending so much time talking about this next film. This is what I think you've all been warning me about. I'm really scared about it. But Steve... Tell us about Nomadland.
You got to wake up now. I know you're watching Nomadland, but you got to wake up.
Vanessa, be prepared to mute Jay and Craig. Just mute them.
Okay.
I have been steeling myself in silence for the assault that I know that will come. Nomadland, it's a drama written, edited, produced, and directed by Chloe Zhao. Stars Frances McDormand as a woman who leaves her hometown of Empire, Nevada after her husband dies and the only industry in town closes down. She is now houseless and decides to travel around the United States. In that journey, she ends up finding a group of nomads who have actually made life on the road their chosen life, and at this desert rendezvous where the nomads meet, she learns tricks for staying alive on the road and how to live, having to basically live out of her van. The interesting thing about this film's origin, it's based on a nonfiction book by Jessica Bruder, who is a professor of subculture and actually spent some time with a group of nomads learning about that subculture. And a number of the people that Jessica Bruder met on that journey are actually in this movie playing themselves. So that adds an air of authenticity to it. The thing about Nomadland is there isn't much of a plot, but there is a story. And the story is about Fern, played by Frances McDormand, trying to come to terms with loss and coming to terms with trying to decide what to do with the rest of her life.
All right, Steve, I thank you for giving us that synopsis. And I thank all the rest of the panelists for only blowing up my chat and not chiming in during Steve's retelling of the movie. So, Steve, tell us, what nominations is this film up for?
Like a lot of the other films we've talked about, Nomadland is up for 6 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director for Chloe Zhao, Best Actress for Frances McDormand, Best Adapted Screenplay by Chloe Zhao, Best Cinematography by Joshua James Richards, and Best Film Editing, also Chloe Zhao.
That's 4 for Chloe Zhao, for those keeping track.
Yeah.
And Steve, I'd like you to start first before the rest of these rabid people jump in on this movie. Who do you think, or what awards do you think it's actually going to take home? Would you say it's going to sweep all of them, or are there any specific ones you'd like to point to?
I don't think it'll be a complete sweep. I think that it has a really good shot at Best Picture. I think Frances McDormand has a really good shot at Best Actress. This would be her third. And I do think, even though, and I should state, I'm not sure that I agree personally with these projected wins, but it's what my head is telling me. I think Chloe Zhao as Best Director has been one of the more controversial choices. But when you look at the fact that she is basically the auteur of this film, writing it, directing it, editing it, I think that the Best Director Award could come her way as well. I don't think screenplay will win. Cinematography, a lot of people are pointing to that as a strength, and it is a, it does provide a lovely backdrop, the American West, for the story. So that's probably a safe category as well. I don't think it'll get Best Film Editing.
All right. Craig McFarlane, would you like to start first?
So here, okay. So here's my beef with Nomadland. There are films that are made in a laboratory that are specifically made for Oscar voters, critics, for people that love the art of film. And certainly many of them in the future will probably star Frances McDormand, because I think that that's her career from here on out is going to be these types of films, which is fine. However, this movie was hyped so much by the critics that were able to see it early. And so going into it, I was really hoping for more than what I got. Steve was right. This movie does not have a plot. It is, as I put in the thread earlier, it is the Seinfeld of movies, in that it's a movie about nothing and people give it way too much credit for what it is. It's not a film that gives you much of anything other than maybe some beautiful landscape shots of America, which I appreciate for sure. But you know, the problem with this film is that I do think, and I mean, I know we're jumping ahead here, I do think it has an excellent shot at winning Best Picture this year. And that saddens me, because in a year where we have such socially relevant films, it makes sense that the Oscars would go with something like this film about a grumpy white lady going across America and peeing in buckets. Like, that makes sense that that's the one that the Oscars decide to go with in this year of pretty impactful film. So
they're going to make up for it by giving the awards to an Asian woman.
Chloe Zhao, I'm glad that she's going to win Best Director. You know, that's great. She's I'm looking forward to the Eternals for sure. But you know, it's one of those things where I wish that the hype train on this wasn't as much as it was in the beginning, because I think that set it up for failure somewhat in my mind. But also I wish that the film had a plot. That also would have helped in maybe my enjoyment of the film. So I yield the floor now for that.
Okay. Thank you, Craig, for telling us about how much you don't like this movie. Lou, I'm not sure where you stand on this, but I am curious to hear what you have to say. What did you think of this film?
Well, I'm going to preface it by saying I don't think it's my favorite film of these nominees. I can understand why someone why it might be hard to gauge with the film. I want to at least acknowledge that, because the film doesn't have a lot of, it's not a very talky movie. There's a lot of vista shots. There's traveling. There's a lot of pondering moments of, but I just fundamentally disagree that it's about nothing. I think about a woman who has lost everything in her life and she does not know where to go. She's mourning. She's mourning the loss of her husband. She's mourning the loss of her livelihood, her town, her community. And I understand what you're saying, Craig, about, you know, things that are going on in this moment, but this movie was based off of real life happenings that happened because of the economic collapse in 2008. So this is real, because those are real people and that really happened to those people. So I think it's understandable why we might want to not, you know, look at what's going on in this moment and say, well, this movie isn't speaking to this moment, but in the same way, it kind of is, because it's a movie about isolation. It's trying to find a group of people, which I know has been tough for all of us in the past year, because we've all been in isolation in one way, shape, or form. So I think there's more to the film than you might be giving it credit for. I understand why it's not going to work for everybody, but I think there's some really beautiful stuff going in there, but it is a movie that I think you do have to, you know, and you do have to engage with the movie, because it's not going to like smack you in the face with what's going on. It's not going to like, it's a very simple movie in a lot of ways. And so I can understand that, but I just think it's a movie worth checking out for all those reasons.
Jay, you are eager to add something to the conversation.
Yes. I get that it's based off real events, but like right before I came down here, I've been stuck at home during COVID and I just cleaned my kitchen for the 847th time. And I felt much more relaxed knowing it was clean, but I'm not suggesting that filming that is moving or that filming that means something. Like, she has very minimal growth to me that I saw. And I saw it as a complete snooze fest. I could hardly keep my eyes open during this movie. And I think more than anything, it was the hype job that has made me so passionate against it. It's not like the movie, like if I just watched it, I'd be like, well, I'll never watch that again. It was the hype job of it's all these awards, all the critics are raving. And it turned it into this film for me where all these critics are saying, look how great this is. And if it's not, there's no connection for a lot. I think a lot of people will struggle to connect with this. It just feels like a bunch of people telling me what I'm supposed to like. So I think as a movie, I don't know if I'd say I wished I didn't see it. It's ho-hum to me. You know, we talk a lot of smack about it, but I think it's much more the hype job on this movie than itself. I would not put this in the Best Picture nominee personally. Like I just don't think there's enough there. And I think it's movies like this and past whatever 20 years we talk about it. Every year the Academies, they're like, why aren't people watching this show? We need to get young hosts to host. Maybe if you put movies that, you know, everybody sees and can connect with and aren't just these critical darlings, but are mainstream and critical and technical and social and all these different things. And this one just feels like more of that. We're force feeding you this type of film. And it's the hype job and the force feeding is why I have the biggest issue with it.
I totally know that I already went, but I just need to like echo what Jay is saying and just saying that this film is forgettable. This film will not live beyond this year. And so many previous Oscar winners are the same way. Things like Crash, things like Slumdog Millionaire. This is the same vein as those types of films. They will not live past this year. There are other films we're going to talk about. There's a film we're going to talk about next that's going to live beyond this year. But this is the film that the Academy is going to choose because the critics all decided that this was the most amazing piece of film ever.
But the critics don't vote. Frustrating. The critics don't vote on Best Picture. I know you guys are like talking about the critic hype train. This is voted on by like producers. It's not voted on by critics.
Right. But who establishes the narrative, Lou?
It doesn't matter. Green Book won the Best winners. Picture. Green Book's got like.
You guys don't like Slumdog Millionaire?
So to be fair, people are still talking about Crash.
Once a week. Okay.
Crash is talked about every day. I don't know what you're talking about. Everyone's talking about Crash.
I definitely want to get to our newest Front Row Network host, but I would like to give Steve Sykes a chance to respond since this, like I said, folks, he has been quiet for most of the discussion. Steve, you wanted to respond to some of these comments.
Well, yeah, I do.
Let him have it then.
First of all, I'm not sure who Frances McDormand is. I know this film starred Frances McDormand.
We're going to let that one slide.
Okay, you can. second of all, the idea that this was manufactured in a lab to be adored by Hollywood critics. Did you see the same movie that I did? This was not aimed at being a critical darling. This was aimed at telling a story. And be very clear, a movie does not have to have a plot to have a story. Now, I am prejudiced on this film because in the year before I saw Nomadland, I lost my job of 28 years. I had been with one company for 28 years and was shown the door. And then 3 months later, I lost my mother. So this movie's themes completely resonated with me. And I think they would with anybody that has either experienced a sudden loss of employment or loss of a loved one or a loss of direction. Coming to a point in your life where you really don't know what it is that you're supposed to do, what anyone really wants of you, what your place is in this world. And these characters physically go out and find it. And I think that is a story that can resonate beyond this year. And that, I believe, is my time.
Steve, I think you make a really good point here. I will just share with you all that when I watched this film, I watched it with someone who has been in the similar shoes, has been homeless and not known where they were going to be sleeping next. And the person I was watching with said, you know, it's not a really exciting movie, but it speaks to me. So with that said, and Steve, I hope this coming year is a lot better for you. I'm sorry you've had so much grief the past year, but
so far, so good.
Okay, good. Good, buddy. Ethan, you are our newest co-host. I want to hear what you have to add to this conversation.
Sure. Thanks. I think I'd just like to echo the sentiments of the whole plot story debate here. I do think that there's something to be said for being able to frame a film around the fact of being lost or not having direction and having the way that that story is told reflect that. Now, whether or not you see that as not having a linear plot and therefore is no plot, I don't know if that's necessarily the case here. I also think that, to Craig's point, I do wish that a lot of these award ceremonies did take into account the popularity of films and films that people are going to talk about for a while. Because I think you can think of any Marvel film or like films like Pineapple Express or any films like that, that people talk about way more than Roma or Crash or Slumdog Millionaire or anything like that. However, I do think that there are echelons to the art form that is film and the films that get created. Like in music, you have things all the way from opera to Katy Perry. And there's going to be things that are more popular than others. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't attain a certain level of art form or sophistication with some of these films just because they're not going to be as popular as the Katy Perry films as well. And I do think that that's the best director, I think, is going to be warranted here, given how much autonomy Chloe Zhao had over the film in writing it, editing it, directing it, capturing that essence of the Nomadland, making it feel like a very lived-in space. I will also agree that it probably wasn't my favorite film of the year. Probably I'm not going to watch it again, but I do appreciate the goal it set out to create and how it was able to achieve that.
Just one clarifying, I didn't say that it had to be the most popular film of the year. I just mean we have so many socially relevant films that are going to live beyond this year that this does not hit that for me. So I don't mean that we should be awarding Godzilla versus Kong because it has the best grossing, highest grossing. You know what I mean? That's all.
Yes, no, I appreciate that. Yeah.
I really like monkey movies, so there. If we can, I'd like to move this on just a little bit more. And Aaron, you haven't had a chance to chime in on this. What would you have to say about this film?
Nomadland is a good movie. It's not the most exciting movie, which I think most people on our particular panel of, you know, our podcast and our hosts agree that a movie doesn't have to be the most exciting to be the most poignant or the most relevant either. Many of us gushed over The Irishman last year, and that moved very slowly. I think many of us agree as well that not the most popular movie has to win, and that obviously we see now it doesn't have to have the biggest plot. The story is clearly relevant. The issue I have with Nomadland, and this is with utmost respect, is that while it's predicated on loss, loss is something that we experience in different ways and different varying degrees all throughout our life and is a normal process and something that we, it's part of life. And so I think when you have a film, and not that I wish loss or, you know, diminish what someone's loss is in their life, I didn't mind watching this movie, but I think what it really boils down to in comparison to what some of the other films bring to the table this year, particularly, I wanted more from Nomadland. I wanted more out of it. I wanted to think more. I wanted to ponder more. Instead, I feel like it fell short of a movie that was technically very good. The cinematography would be warranted. The editing was wonderful. There's some great sweeping skates, but I do feel like the film relied heavily on landscape and on the stories, not of the main actor, but of the other people in the film. And so I was left kind of, I felt like it fell short. You know, I think that there are aspects of it that are wonderful, and I don't think it's the worst film that was ever made or the most boring, but I do agree. I don't know that it's one. I think there are other films about loss that have left me thinking a lot more. I love a film that makes me feel like I had a little bit too much to think. And I don't think Nomadland does that. I think it misses the mark on that. And that's why I kind of feel the way I do about it.
We'll get back to a few more closing thoughts on this film, but I do want to ask Brandon, since, you know, Aaron mentioned cinematography, and that does seem like a nomination that it could win and beat out Mank. Any thoughts on that, Brandon?
No, it wouldn't shock me. I think it's a beautiful, beautifully shot movie. We argue about this a lot, but I'm just going to say, I think had people seen this on a big screen, they might have different opinions of it. And, you know, we go back and forth on whether or not, you know, we should be doing that. You know, it, in my opinion, I think it would change some opinions in some ways regarding that. But just my thought, like, some movies are big 300-page epics. Some movies are like, you know, 100-page, like Harlequin novel page turners. Some are like big, colorful comic books. This movie was a beautiful 3-paragraph poem. And I think it didn't, you know, it didn't move fast. It didn't say a lot, but what it did say, it said in like 3 paragraphs. And I think it was just to leave you, it was to leave you thinking with just a few thoughts as you left. And it told it in a very visual, beautiful, and stunning way.
Well said. And I'm going to go to Ryan last because he has promised me that he will keep his comments brief. But before we do, Steve, any final thoughts since this was your film to discuss?
Well, and that's exactly it. I wanted to make the point, excuse me, that I don't think that Nomadland is the best picture of the year, personally. I'll leave that little bit of suspense for later for what I think should win, but I will fight you physically about this being a boring movie or a movie that is of no consequence. I think it was a very important film. I thought it did speak to me, even though it's not the best picture of the year. I think it does deserve to be among the nominees.
And I'm very glad that this is a Zoom recording, so I don't have to ref the physical fighting. But Ryan, take us home with your final thoughts on Nomadland.
So Nomadland, it hit me at a time when I had just lost my mother. And there was a scene at the very end where a real life person was talking with Frances McDormand about loss and and it really chimed in with me. And that's just me. This movie is just a very straight journey movie. But to me, it doesn't need to be anything else. This is a movie that is praised for its technicality. But we are all, you know, what I like to say, especially when I talk to my students when it comes to movie is, you know, is don't listen to critics. We are all critics on this panel, and I respect each and every one of you's opinions. And I like your guys' opinion because it keeps me in check. That's what's great about the Front Row Network. But this film, it is going to win Best Picture in my mind, just because of the fact that it was very well put together. And in a year where there was heavy losses across the world in terms of COVID deaths, people are going through losses. They might not watch it because they don't like the critics, like my Jay and Craig said. You know, they'd rather see Godzilla versus Kong, but they may catch it at some point and it may chime in then. Those are my thoughts. Let's talk about a movie that really we all love.
Excellent. Well, I was going to say, just like No Man's Land, we've talked a long time and gotten nowhere on a final decision on if it will win or if it won't for Best Picture. But since we've talked about grief for so long, let's talk about something exciting, the patriarchy. Aaron, would you like to talk about Promising Young Woman?
Let's talk about something exciting.
Yeah. Right.
So Promising Young Woman is a film that focuses on a 30-year-old medical school dropout, Cassie Thomas. She lives at home with her parents. She spends her days working in a coffee shop and her nights pretending like she's inebriated so that she can lure men into, I wouldn't say lure, but almost luring men into the enticement of deciding to prey on her in an inebriated and vulnerable state. And she then turns the tables on these men. And when they make moves on her and advance sexually upon her, she shows them she's not actually drunk and, you know, kind of takes it to them to put them in their place and make them realize what they're doing. And so she kind of becomes a vigilante of sorts while also working out all of the mental and emotional anguish of dealing with the death of her best friend in college, who we find out later in the movie was raped by another classmate while drunk. She was not her her perpetrator was never brought to justice. And the movie kind of goes through all of the layers of complexity in cases like this, where women are in situations like this in colleges where they may not be believed, how other classmates viewed the experience or their memory of, or their complicit nature in the event. And it ends up taking it to a very dark and exciting ending where I don't want to give it away. I'd rather listeners actually go and watch it, but it becomes quite a revenge story. So this movie is nominated for 5 Academy Awards. It's up for Best Picture, Best Director with Emerald Fennell, Best Original Screenplay, also for Emerald Fennell, Best Actress with Carey Mulligan, and Best Film Editing. So my critique of this film, like I mentioned, I'm up for films that leave me thinking, leave me contemplating, and I actually love a good movie that makes me sit in the discomfort of gray areas. And 5, yeah, as I always said. And I think this movie, is it 5? Yeah, it's 5. I think this movie does this, and I think it does it well. I think Emerald Fennell does an amazing job of not spelling everything out in this film, ethically and morally. And it leaves you thinking about it. How ethically flexible are you as the viewer? How, you know, how have these situations or involvement in, or, you know, your own college experience or experiences in general, how these played into your own life? You know, a lot of us, you know, either being female or being male, have maybe been in some of these situations or heard about. And so I think this is what I think this movie is the Get Out of the Oscars this year. I think this is a film that isn't going to win a whole lot, but it deals with a topic that no one wants to touch. And it does it in such an amazingly intelligent way. I think Emerald Fennell is, in my opinion, should win Best Director. I think she takes this topic and she doesn't waste a frame. She uses every cinematic and directorial trick in the book to convey not only the main character's mental anguish and wrestling with the situation as the story moves along, but she also uses the story and like the poppy kind of feel it has, I think, to kind of convey that sometimes some of that bubblegum pop gets women not taken seriously. So I just think there's like layers and layers of intelligence in this film that it's going to take a little while for us to move out of the window of its release for us to really understand its relevance in the cultural zeitgeist. I really think that the only thing it's going to take home, maybe Carey Mulligan is going to win Best Actress, although I'm not convinced. I think if anything, it's going to take home Best Original Screenplay, much like Jordan Peele did with Get Out.
Very good. And that was a film that seems to be propelling itself with all this momentum kind of at the last minute, which is why everybody's talking about it. But I want to talk to Steve and see what comments that he had on this film.
This is the film that I've caught most recently. And I have to say, and I feel guilty for saying this, but for my money, this is like the most fun film of the Best Picture nominees. And I say that knowing that it's about sexual assault and all these other gray, dark areas. But the way that Emerald Fennell takes you through the twists and turns of the story and motivations is amazing. I thought I knew what this movie was going to be about, and they dispensed with that in the first 5 minutes. And I'm like, oh, okay, so this is obviously not going where I thought it was going to go. I agree 100% that this should get Best Adapted Screenplay. It just was entertaining, but like Aaron said, definitely one you're going to think about for a long time after you see it.
Jay, you had some thoughts.
Yeah, I think this movie is kind of the one I was trying to describe earlier when I said this is what I want to see out of Best Pictures. It's one where you think, Aaron kind of described it as poppy. I'd say a little pulpy even, you know, just with the lighting and with the way some of the situations are handled and the music. And this felt very much like a mainstream movie, but this is by far the one I left thinking the most about. And I think it was amazing taking this very, very, you know, middle of the Me Too movement right now. This is absolutely in the forefront socially, and to take this thing and not only to bring it in, as Steve said, an entertaining way, which is absolutely mind blowing to say, like, this movie's super entertaining. Like, you're really gripped by it. It is such troubling topic area that it covers, but I don't know, this movie, like they both said, we're going to be talking about this movie for a really, really long time. This is the kind of movie I want to see nominated for best picture in the future, and obviously it's going to be hard to replicate this movie because it was just able to hit this really tough topic and not just say, here's our thoughts on it. It was like, hey, here's all these different things that go along with it. There's administrative issues. There's a drinking culture that's involved. There's not wanting to tell on your friends. There's all these different things that she throws in there into this movie. Says, these are issues, and you need to make some thoughts on it, and you need to think about it. And I'm not here to tell you the answer. I'm here to tell you these are all leading indicators of this major issue. And I think that's what made it really so amazing.
I do think it's going to take home Best Original Screenplay. It does sound like that from what everyone's been saying here and online. But the real question, I think, for a lot of people is, yes, could it take that Best Picture possibly? But also Carey Mulligan for Best Actress. I've heard people say that, you know, her portrayal is just angry, kind of angry woman. There's not much there. But really, in the end, there's a lot going on toward the end of the movie to point to for that nomination. Ryan, you said that you liked this film. Do you have any thoughts on Carrie or the anything else in the film?
I just need to talk about a snub. But this movie was beautifully written. Carey Mulligan, I will be very upset if she does not win. Probably the atrocity that the Academy did this year was not nominating Stars Are Blind by for Best Original Song. I said it, stand by it. That's all I got.
And I'm not sure if that cut out a bit. It did on my end, but it Stars Are Blind by Paris Hilton. Is that correct?
He got cut out for a reason.
Yeah.
Oh, no, okay.
That's not the best. No,
that was Paris God Hilton, intervening.
Stars Are Blind.
Sadly, it's not eligible due to technicality rules things.
Like being 10 years old?
That's part of it.
Anyone have anything else on this film since it is a favorite? Yes, Craig.
You know, and I apologize. I've spoken on almost, I swear I'm not going to speak on Sound of Metal. And then that way I can actually not speak on one of these films. But, you know, what I love too is that thought about it even down to the minutiae of the casting of these males that are going to kind of be our villains throughout this. And she picked even people that we have seen in so many different identifiable roles, and they're typically the good guy. They're typically the guy that you root for. And now they're these villains. They're these guys that you dread when they make their turns. You know, McLovin in his acting, the guy from New Girl, you know, just like all these roles that you know them from something else. You easily recognize them. And then they're terrible people in this film. And it shows that not every, it shows that it is possible that every guy could fall susceptible to something like this or to doing something like this, and that we all need to be vigilant. And as a guy watching this film, that's one of the things I took away from it is like, what have I, you know, I've been with my wife now since high school, but even in situations where like you could say something inappropriate that you don't think is inappropriate at the time, and just being able to check yourself and focus on actually respecting a woman, you know. And I think that is also part of the through line of this film as well, because it works on a lot of different levels. It's easily the best script of the year. Sorry for hoarding this whole podcast.
Oh, that's okay. Jay, go ahead.
Just to add, I think the casting in this overall is really amazing. So you should check out our full disclosure on this, because we absolutely get into the casting. That's including her parents, Clancy Brown, who's always a tough guy, is a just completely broken down man who doesn't know how to help his daughter who's struggling. And his wife is Stifler's mom, who is absolutely not playing Stifler's mom in this. And even Carey Mulligan herself has had roles in the past, you know, where this is the absolute opposite of her character. So all throughout this movie is littered with that. You can hear more about that on our full disclosure.
I'm going to bring up just one last thing. In terms of my campaign for Emerald Fennell as the best director, not only did she film this in 23 days while pregnant and very pregnant. Okay, so she was 3D printing a person while filming this piece. Also, I just want to add in, you know, we keep joking about the Paris Hilton song, and it's like easy to laugh off Paris Hilton based on what we thought. And I brought this up in our text thread before, but I think this speaks to the layers of intentionality that Emerald Fennell had in this film. She purposely put music in by Paris Hilton and Britney Spears, two women who have been very much chewed up and spit out by, you know, star culture. and not always taken very seriously. In fact, Britney Spears, you know, there's an amazing rendition of Toxic, violin rendition of Toxic in this film, but Britney Spears for years complained she was tired and she was tired and she was tired, and no one believed her until she shaved her head. And then after that, everyone said she was crazy. So I just think there's even more, like, there just are so many aspects of this film that Emerald Fennell, there's so many details that she did not miss, and it's worth mentioning. And that's another reason why, not saying that Nomadland is not a great film or that Chloe Zhao is not a great director, I just think Emerald took it to a different level than what some of the other films that are getting all the hype have done.
I want to end it. There you go. I want to end it with Aaron's thoughts. I think that's a great way to end talking about that film. And let's move on to Sound of Metal. And Lou, you're going to tell us about that one.
Yes, I will. So Sound of Metal tells the story of Ruben, a recovering heroin addict and heavy metal drummer whose world is shattered when he loses his hearing. The film takes us through Ruben's journey of both learning to function as a deaf person with the help of a mentor and the deaf community, while also working towards a cochlear implant that may help him regain his hearing and hopefully his ability to play music again. I really like this movie. It stars Riz Ahmed in the title role. His girlfriend is played by Olivia Cooke, and then his mentor is played by Paul Racy. One of the things I really liked about the movie, you know, every year when you have Best Picture nominees, there's usually always some like kind of indie feeling film. And I feel like, you know, Ethan, maybe you can back me up on this. This is the most, to me, this is the movie that had the most indie feel to it, in that it's fairly straightforward in its approach. It's fairly low budget. And it's a very pretty simple story. It pretty much follows one character. It's similar to Nomadland in that way, in that it follows kind of just really one character as they're dealing with a sudden loss. But what I also thought about it is, to echo some of the things I said about Nomadland, even though it's a movie, this is a movie about somebody becoming deaf, I don't necessarily think it's a movie that you can't connect to, even if you've never known someone who's deaf or been gone, you know, become deaf yourself, because really what the movie's about is what happens when you lose the thing you love the most and you lose it in an instant. He didn't know this was coming, and he has to kind of rebuild, and he goes through the stages of grief. He goes through the desire to try to regain his hearing and what are the complications of that, or to accept what's going on and what are the complications of that. There's a lot of things that are, I think, are going on. It's really at its heart a performance piece for Riz Ahmed, who I think is phenomenal in this movie. You know, I'll always support my man Carlton Drake from Venom, but even if he wasn't in one of my favorite Trash Baby movies, I would still love his performance in this movie, because I think he's just really great in it. But the thing that makes this, I think, takes this from just being an average movie about loss that maybe something, you know, I say that and you might hear, oh, I've seen that before, is that the movie does a wonderful job at putting you in the shoes of Ruben through its sound design. It's a really immersive experience in that way. It's not a flashy movie in terms of cinematography or camera tricks or edits or things like that. You know, it's not directed with a lot of stylistic flourishes, but through its sound design, it really does take you through that journey of what it might be like to lose your hearing and how sound impacts. So I know we talk a lot about movies that you should see this movie on the big screen. This movie, I'll say, you don't necessarily need to see it on the big screen. You could see it. I think it'll work fine on any device, but make sure you have, if you're going to watch it on a mobile device, put your headphones on, put your earbuds in so you can hear what's going on with this movie, because that's, I think, a character in the film that works better than, I mean, almost any sound I've heard in a film. So it's nominated for 6 Academy Awards, Best Picture, Best Actor for Riz Ahmed, Best Supporting Actor for Paul Racy, Best Sound, Best Original Screenplay, and then Film Editing. So I think if it doesn't win best sound, that's a crime. I'll 100% stump for that. I don't know if it's got a chance in really any other category. Even though I like this movie a lot, I think it's a really strong year. And I think for Riz Ahmed, I would not be, if Chadwick Boseman was not in the equation this year, I would be more than happy to see him win this award. But I think Riz Ahmed is going to be giving great performances for a very, very long time. And I don't think when it's all said and done, I think he'll have an Oscar at some point, but maybe just not this year.
Lou, since you mentioned that this is the indie film of our Best Picture nominees, I'd like to go to Ethan to see what his thoughts are plugging Craig as the new host of our indie podcast, Indie Spotlight, I believe is what we said. So Ethan, what are your thoughts on this film being an indie film?
Yeah, I agree with almost everything Lou said. I really, really enjoy this movie. Not from just being a musician myself, but from how all of the ways that he was displaying his grief were portrayed, often through sound. The anxiousness and the tenuousness of what he could hear and what he couldn't really came through. And that was what was telling the story almost more than anything anybody was saying or doing. I really enjoyed his performance. I enjoyed his mentor's performance a lot as well. I had a couple issues with pacing and some stuff like that. But other than that, I thought it was a really good film. And I think I agree that if not for Chadwick Boseman, this would be my best actor choice. Not having seen The Father, but out of anything else, I think that this was my favorite performance of the year outside of Chadwick as well.
Steve, you had thoughts on the film.
Well, everybody else is promoting their podcast, so I figured I would promote mine.
Absolutely.
View from the Back Row is about disability inclusion and representation in movies, and this is a fine example of that. Sound and Metal used a lot of deaf actors from the deaf community. They did a lot of research in sign language and other aspects of life for the deaf. And this is actually a great year for disability representation. There's a phenomenal short film that stars a deaf and blind actor, Feeling Through, that is also nominated. But among all of the other wonderful things about this movie, the representation in it is near and dear to my heart.
Excellent. Jay, you had something to add about this film.
Yeah, I watched it last night, and this was what I've kind of been pushing off. It kind of struck me as like a weird one in the Best Picture mix, just based off of just not hearing a lot of chatter, seeing the trailer. It looked like a pretty decent drama, and I can't believe how much this one connected. I connected with this one. Like, it like blew me away. And the sound, all the sound stuff Lou is saying, yes, the sound, holy crap. You know, we're trying to do 3D and smell-o-vision, and we're not even thinking what you can do with sound in a movie. And this movie, little drama movie, shows you all that. But really, the performance and the character stuff really kicked me in the chest a little bit. This dude's 4 years sober in the movie. Hey, guess what? Me too. So that kind of hit me. And there's one scene in particular. You guys are describing him losing his hearing as grief, and I had a different interpretation. And maybe it's just me not being in touch with that emotional part that's somewhere supposed to be located in my body that I can't find. I thought it was him struggling with a lack of control, which is an issue I have, which maybe that's grief and maybe it's just part of the whole process. But the scene where he's just kicking the crap out of everything in his RV and breaking things, I was like, oh, that's, I'm that guy. I'm Captain Hothead. That's what I do when I lose control, is like to break things. And I connected so strongly with that scene. And I try to be all very open about this stuff too. And man, this movie kind of kicked me in the chest with that. But I think the point I wanted to make is, you know, Ryan and Steve both talked about why they had such a strong connection with Nomadland. I did not expect this to be the movie I had this really strong, like, emotional connection with. And that's, man, that's like the beauty of why we're the podcast for people that like movies. Yeah, we're giving each other a hard time, giving these movies a hard time, but it's about finding the right movie for you. And that's what this made me think of, how those guys, their lives at this point in time connected them. Man, that's me right now. I feel we're at home, stuck in COVID, just had a fourth kid. Holy crap. Like, literally the whole story I just shared, everything was, has been a total nightmare at our house for the past week and a half. And then I watched that movie. I'm like, oh my God, I feel no control over anything either. So I feel every bit of his rage and lost control. So I'll stop going on and on.
Oh, I'm really glad you added that. I think that gives us all some really unique insight into that film and how it can be interpreted. And thank you for sharing that. Ryan, you had some thoughts on the sound category.
Last year when Aaron and Jay and I were talking, or last year we talked Ford versus Ferrari, and we talked about sound mixing and sound editing. This year it's all best sound, and I think this movie really nails the nail on the head. It's just what they do with sound and how he's losing sound and muffling sound, distorting sound. You know, when he gets his cochlear implant, it's all distorted. Like, I mean, you could literally, I gotta make it weird. Sorry.
Just keep going. I'm with you, man. I'm with you.
It's, you could close your eyes and this movie would still, it'd be a different experience. I mean, the sound is just very well done in this movie, and thank God for that. So
I haven't yet to seen this movie, so I might have to take both. I think it was Lou said to put it in the headphones, and then I'll try it without watching it visually. We have one more film left to go to. Lou, what's your final thought on this film, and then we'll move on.
Okay. So I want to say, I think I love what Jay says about the film and what he was going through. What struck me too is, you know, I think everybody has dreams in their life that get canceled sometimes. The life doesn't work out. Like, and sometimes it's like, and what this guy's dream was to be a drummer, and it's taken away from him, and he has to regroup and figure out what his new life is going to look like on the other side of this. And not only in the current context we're in, where, you know, COVID took us all by surprise, and a lot of people I know lost their dreams in the process. They lost family members or their livelihoods or whatever. And we keep talking right now in this phase we're in about a new normal or going back to normal. And it's a myth. We're not going to go back to the way we were a year ago. We're just not. And things are going to look different even when COVID isn't around anymore. And I think this movie kind of really does a good job of talking about a point about, it's not about trying to regain the thing that you used to have. It's trying to rebuild and do something, you know, find a new path. Not to spoil the ending at all, because I don't think I am, but that's what really struck me about it was, you know, we've all had things in our life that we wanted to happen and then they didn't. And then we had to regroup and go a different way maybe. And learning about that struggle, I think, makes it a really universal movie. And then the last thing that I will say is, I mentioned how Riz is so also great in Venom. If you want to hear more about Venom, you can go to my podcast, Guilty Pleasures, in the archive and hear our podcast on Venom. That's the only way I'm going to work a plug in for my show, because I talk about garbage movies. You all get the prestige crap, and I'm over here Venom for crying out loud. So I'm done.
Has everybody gotten to plug at this point now?
I will say, I was going to mention that we have not plugged Beyond the Mouse, but the only Disney property in this year's Best Picture race is Nomadland. So it's obvious why I didn't plug the Disney property with the Disney show. So go check out Beyond the Mouse. We are awesome.
All right.
Visigoth.
Okay, guys, we've got one more to do. We can do this. Let's pull our energy together. We need to talk about Craig's film, which is The Trial of the Chicago Seven. I'd like everybody to interrupt Craig since he's done that for the rest of this podcast. But Craig, you can lead us off.
Did you mean, I didn't hear you say the SAG award winner for Best Ensemble the trial of the Chicago Seven, because in fact, this is a film that's based on the infamous 1969 trial of seven defendants who were charged by the federal government with conspiracy and more arising from a countercultural protest in Chicago around the 1968 Democratic National Convention. The trial transfixed the nation and sparked a conversation about mayhem intended to undermine the U.S. government. And I've got to say, you know, the first thing you're going to hear about this film, and it's rightly so, is that it was written and directed by Aaron Sorkin. And Sorkin has this way with words and this way with dialogue. And actually, to promote our full disclosure from November, when Steve and Lou and I spoke about this movie, I think we all kind of agreed that we actually like his legal dramas even more so than we like some of his political movies. And this falls in that category because he does such a great job of making the courtroom exciting, making the courtroom accessible. It's incredible to think about the turmoil that was 1968. If you think about that year, you had so many deaths and assassinations going on amongst a war that the country was divided over. And so this film really allows you to be put into that place, to be put in that courtroom, to experience 1968 and to live it through this amazing ensemble of people that I will get to in just a moment. But Sorkin does do such a wonderful job of bringing it all to us. And it's kind of ridiculous thinking about it back to it from a historical aspect that the federal government decided, the prosecutors decided to group these seven. There were actually eight men together at the beginning to try to formulate some kind of vast conspiracy against the government, when truly these were individuals that came to this protest, to this Democratic convention on their own, and to be able to present that on the screen. I think that they did it in such a great way. The cast is absurd. It's an amazing cast. Eddie Redmayne, Alex Sharp, Sacha Baron Cohen, of course, Sacha Baron Cohen being nominated for an Oscar, Jeremy Strong, John Carroll Lynch, Yahya Abdul-Mateen II gives such an amazing and impactful performance as Bobby Seale. And he was the eighth. He would have been trial of the Chicago eighth had Bobby Seale continued on with that trial. But then you have, you know, previous Oscar winners like Mark Rylance in this film as well. And I haven't even said the name Frank Langella yet, but it's amazing the ensemble that they brought together, the script that they put together. And this film really does pack quite the punch. In terms of nominations, it is also nominated for 6 Academy Awards. And I wonder if they did that on purpose. Just about every film we've talked about tonight was nominated in 6 different categories. And the categories that it was nominated in are Best Picture, Best Supporting Actor with Sacha Baron Cohen, Best Original Screenplay by Aaron Sorkin, Best Film Editing, Best Cinematography, and Best Original Song. So those are the categories. I would say that the ones I suspect they have a decent shot at winning, you know, you might give it a possibility for film editing. I do also think that if anything is going to take on Nomadland, it is going to be this film as a potential, because Sorkin has such weight in Hollywood and because it is a well-done and well-written film as well. As far as original screenplay, I really want Promising Young Woman to win that, so I don't want to root for Trial of the Chicago 7 there. So that's what I have about this movie. Definitely go and check it out. It's very accessible on Netflix. Go and watch it now if you can.
This does seem like a film that the Academy could push through over Nomadland, but that is still to be seen. Steve, you were not pleased with a snub.
Yeah, actually, I was glad to see that Chicago 7 got a Best Supporting Actor nomination, but I think they nominated the wrong guy. I would have put Frank Langella up there. I think that his performance, it's not as lengthy or as meaty as Sacha Baron Cohen's, but it's just fantastic as the presiding judge in the trial. That's,
I'm just glad you didn't
thing.
Say Eddie Redmayne.
No, we had that discussion.
Well, it's really funny because when we were talking about this way back in November, we talked about the idea that there were so many possible best supporting actors out of this. I would have never thought in a million years that actually Judas and the Black Messiah would have gotten the two nominations. I would have thought that it would have went to Trial of the Chicago Seven in terms of in that particular category. But it's just an embarrassment of riches in terms of the ensemble for this show.
So it does seem like that this is the film we've talked about, Promising Young Woman possibly getting that best picture, but this seems like the film that could possibly do it. Would anybody like to make a case for this to be the winner for best picture? Lou?
Are you asking me to make a case against specifically Nomadland? Or are you asking
me to make a case? We're good there. Okay. We've got that for days. Just want to hear if anyone thinks this film could sneak in Best Picture or really any of the other categories. Lou, it looks like you might have had a thought on this.
Well, I mean, it wasn't going to be to stump for it. It was actually going to say it's really rare that a movie can win Best Picture without its director even being nominated. Mm-hmm. So I do think that's and I think I said this on the Full Disclosure. I think it's a better written film than it is a directed film. And it's a really good ensemble, but I think to me, if you're gonna, my spoiler pick for Best Picture, if it's not Nomadland, is actually Minari, because I think it checks all of those boxes, and I think it's another good ensemble piece. I actually think, you know, every year there's a movie that gets a lot of nominations and then gets shut out. Irishman got 10 nominations last year, didn't win a single one, and it was the one with all the big name ID. And so to me, this feels like kind of that same thing where it's this movie that on paper seems like it should win a bunch of stuff. It's got a great name ID. But then when you look at its each individual matchups, I think it's actually going to get shut out. The only thing that I could see happening is if Daniel Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield split the vote because people like that movie and no one is sure who to vote for in that. And like Sacha Baron Cohen sneaks in like as a spoiler there, but I actually think it's going to get shut out.
Yeah, that definitely could be the case. Not impossible to not get the best director and then get best picture, but that is the norm to get both. Any final thoughts on this film, folks, before we wrap this show up?
I got to share the power of Michael Keaton, because Michael Keaton has been in Best Ensemble in two previous movies and they would go on to win Best Picture. So I think this is going to be the third one that is not going to happen. I think I agree with Lou. I think a lot of the things too is that this movie came out a little bit too early. But I think this movie is going to be largely sub. I think Mank with 10 is at least going to get production design.
All right. Well, I hope for the listeners that we've given you some idea on some of the categories besides Best Picture, but now I'm going to give our panelists each a turn. Since it is going a little late, I'm going to give you 1 minute-ish to 1 minute to tell us who you think is going to win. And then, of course, you can tell us who you think should win, but wouldn't be the case to be the winner. So, I've got my stopwatch. I'm very serious about this because I do want to go to bed. So I'm going to start off with, let's start. I'm just going to call on you randomly, if that's okay. Let's start off with Aaron.
Who do I think is going to win Best Picture? Yes. I think the Academy is going to disappoint us after Parasite last year and give it to Nomadland. I think that's the safe choice. Even though there's several other amazing films, that's what my head says. My heart would love it to be Promising Young Women, but like I said, I don't think that's going to happen. So,
all right, thank you. You did that in under 30 seconds. Let's see if anybody can beat that. Steve, do you want to go next?
I do think Nomadland will win. I think there's just too much of a tidal wave of critical support for it. But I really think Judas and the Black Messiah was the best film of the year. And I really would love to see that win. And if Daniel Kaluuya does not win Best Supporting Actor, I'm going to flip tables.
Okay. I don't want you to do that. So for your sake, I hope that's the case. Let's go to Jay.
Want and Will, Promising Young Women. Stop the clock.
Okay. You heard it. Craig.
You know, I think that the Academy disappoints me a lot and often. I think they will give it to Nomadland. And I think that the film that should win, you've got two pieces. You've got Trial of the Chicago 7, Judas and the Black Messiah, about a lot of the same time period, about a lot of the same issues going on. I think you have to give the edge after this last year and what we've been through to Judas and the Black Messiah. I think that that is a Black-led film. I think that it is a very culturally relevant film. And I think that it's an important film that will live on well beyond this year.
Ethan, let's go to you.
Sure. I also think Nomadland is going to win. I think other films like Minari, unfortunately, because Parasite won last year, kind of disqualifies that story to win again, because I just don't think Americans are going to give Koreans awards twice in a row. I just don't think that's going to happen. So because of that, Judas and the Black Messiah is also my choice, not only for the exposure of the story and its relevance and importance, but because of how well it was done and acted as well.
Lou?
All right. Upset special. I'm picking Minari to win Best Picture. I think Chloe Zhao is going to win Best Director. I think Minari is going to win Best Picture. I think there's been some backlash on Nomadland, especially, and we got to remember the voting has only been going on for about a month. Is that right? About right. So think about also what's been going on in America in the past month. We've had a lot of hate crimes against Asian Americans, and a lot of prominent voices are raising up and saying we need to be telling those stories more. And Minari is doing that. And it's a movie about the Asian American experience at a time where we are starting to pay attention to how we've been mistreating Asian Americans in this country for years. So I actually think it's going to be an upset. I'm running out of time, so I don't have to say what I want because I don't know what I want yet this year.
Okay.
Check Brandon. Out my article on NPR Illinois if I ever write it.
All right. No more plugging for the rest of this podcast, everybody. Brandon, you're up next.
I think Nomadland will win. I think Judas and the Black Messiah and Promising Young Woman are the two movies that are going to live beyond this year. So those would be like one of my two picks of what will win. But I would just want to take up my minute. I hate when the Oscars have 10 slots and they only pick 9 movies. I think Ma Rainey's Black Bottom deserved a nomination.
Hear, hear.
It's a fair point.
Beautiful movie that will also live past this year.
Yes.
Ryan, take Agreed. Us home.
So I'm just going to finish up by saying, check out, our, spreadsheet where we, lead with our, you can guess with your head, lead with your heart. So in true Aaron fashion, I'm going to say in my head, I know Nomadland's going to win. You know, it is a technical award. It is done. It's what the Academy likes to see, but in my heart of hearts, Judas and the Black Messiah and Promising Young Women would make me truly happy and my heart happy.
Can we also say that Shaka King not being nominated for Best Director is just a real travesty for Judas and the Black Messiah? Okay, that's my dad.
We can say that. We had a little extra time there. So, all right. Well, listeners, I hope we helped you fill out the ballots. The good news is that you, by the time you hear this, you'll still have a little bit of time to listen to what's going on in the news and who they think's going to win. And hopefully you'll have all the correct guesses on your Oscar ballot. But did any of our panelists like to add anything else before we close out this podcast?
I just want to say how wonderful a job Vanessa Ferguson has done at hosting this madcap episode for us. And hear, hear. What a wonderful job she does co-hosting Beyond the Mouse on NPR Illinois Community Voices, a podcast all about Disney.
To be fair, I want to thank Vanessa so much. Oscars is my thing, and I just didn't want to host and do the father. So Vanessa, thank you. But it was Craig who offered you as a sacrifice.
Well, thank you to your both. That's exactly what I was hoping to hear in that slot that I set up. So, but that does it for us here on The Front Row. You can find all The Front Row's content and channels wherever you get your podcast fix from. If you want to leave us a comment during the Oscars, you can definitely do that. You can find us on Facebook. Just search The Front Row Network. You can also find our website online by searching The Front Row Network, or you can find us on nprillinois.org. thank you to our panelists for joining us for Oscar week coverage. No, Lou, you cannot plug anything else. All right. Well, this better be it. I mean it. This is this to be the very last plug for this episode.
Well, I'm just saying, Flashbacks plugged their Oscar episode. Let me plug my Oscar episode. And it is an Oscar episode because we're talking about 1991's Oscar starring Sylvester Stallone for Oscar week, 30th anniversary. You got to do it.
Oh my
Stallone
God,
in a farce.
Movie. And it stars Marissa Tomei.
Yeah.
And Aaron's pretty much in that movie. That's so crazy. See, it all circled back.
See, I bring things together.
It all makes sense. So I hope you will join us in watching the 93rd Annual Academy Awards Sunday, April 25th at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central on ABC. Again, thank you so much for listening. I hope we helped you fill up that ballot. And we will see you again in the front row.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Front Row Network, a proud Community Voices member of National Public Radio Illinois. For more from the Front Row Network, including our articles or our other dozens of shows, visit thefrontrownetwork.com or nprillinois.org/programs/frontrownetwork. You can also find us on social media by searching for the Front Row Network on Facebook, YouTube, and Instagram, and on Twitter @FrontRowReviews with a Z.